Hey everyone, it's Alex from Alex Company. Tyrone has completed another great interview in our Hey Algorithms Meet Biorhythms series. The series was largely inspired by the book Sense Making, The Power of the Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. Today, Tyrone had the pleasure of speaking with the book's author, Christian Mautzberg. Christian is co-founder and partner at Red Associates, a strategic consultancy in New York City that helps clients see new business opportunities through the use of social sciences to study how and why people behave the way they do. This podcast has been produced by Fat Cat Productions. Check them out at fatcatprods.com. That's FATCATPRODS.com. For all of your audio and video production needs, reach out to Jeff at Fat Cat Productions. We hope you enjoy the dialogue. Thanks for listening.
It's so great to meet you. Thank you so much for making time to meet with me today.
Of course.
We're doing a series called Hey Algorithms Meet Biorhythms. And it's very much, it was very much inspired by your book, Sense Making. It really called a lot to mind on kind of like issues that are going on right now. It helped for me to kind of reinforce the importance of, you know, qualitative insight in terms of brand planning and strategy and stuff like that. You know, I just wanted to do a little bit of an introduction. You're one of the founders of Red Associates, a strategic consultancy firm in New York City that helps clients see new business opportunities through the use of social sciences to study how and why people behave the way they do. You also wrote, co-authored in 2014, The Moment of Clarity, Using the Human Sciences to Solve Your Toughest Business Problems with, please forgive me if I pronounce it wrong, is it Mikkel or Michael?
B. Rasmussen?
Mikkel, thank you. Yeah. B. Rasmussen. And that was on Harvard Business Review Press. And most recently, you wrote Sense Making, The Power of Humanities in the Age of the Algorithm. Can you explain sense making in a way that it can kind of help people understand how they can get insights, how they can get consumer insights?
Yes. I think if you talk about algorithms and data, which is the craze among the listeners right now because of the access to new sets of data that we didn't have before, I think just get back to first principles of the statistics, which is that a correlation doesn't necessarily give causation. And there has been and still is an absurd idea happening, which is that sample size, so the amount of data you have, solves the problem of causation and correlation.
Sure.
It does not. I mean, you can mathematically prove, and we've known since Newton, that is simply incorrect. Yet people say, you know, because we have 3.5 billion impressions on Facebook, that means that we can explain why people do what they do.
Yeah.
And that's simply just really bad statistics. Mm-hmm. So if you can certainly create correlations, and you can create correlation out of any data set, but whether that correlation has any merit in terms of explaining things, so causation about things, is simply just really bad statistics.
Yeah.
So the question is then, how do you get at causation? Mm-hmm. Now, there are many ways of doing that, but one of them is to observe and to listen. Mm-hmm. And use maybe other sciences than the techniques that are inspired by physics. That's economics and big parts of sociology, big parts of psychology, the part of them that are about looking at people in their context. And sense making is just a name. I mean, I could have called it Mickey Mouse, but I called it sense making.
Sure.
Is the techniques with which you observe how people live, fall in love, mm-hmm. buy things, find things important and non-important, relevant and not relevant in their lives.
Yeah.
And then you can do the statistics moves, right? So it is basically the creation of context-saturated hypotheses that can be tested at a large scale. So it's basically just a defense of, or a call for context.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the and it's really banal. If you take the note, the musical note C, mm-hmm. that note can be played in a classical concert, in a Beethoven concert in Carnegie Hall, mm-hmm. or it can be played by a death metal band in Finland. Sure. It's in the same situations. It's the note C, but it sounds pretty different. And that just explains that the context of something, of a data point, mm-hmm. that might be very clearly possible to register, so it has the same sound, sound waves, and it is received by your ear in the same technical way, but sounds completely different and is. So if you want to understand a data point, having the context is rather helpful.
Super helpful.
And the problem is that you then have to go to people's contextual lives and try to understand what's going on. Anthropologists would call thick description or thick data.
That's actually the next question I have is that, we were talking about analog data in our last interview. Graham Hall was talking about the importance of really just needing and just really start engaging with target customers. And he was doing interviews, but you emphasize thick data in your book. Can you explain what thick data is?
Right. So it is the description of human experience. Mm. So it's the description of how someone or a group, most likely a group, experience something. So the word freedom is rather different to a Midwestern Republican than the context of the word freedom to someone that lives in China, in the eastern part of China. Mm-hmm. The same word and the same, quite frankly, code in a big data set means completely different things. And in order to understand what it means different places, you have to go and meet them.
Yeah.
Now, why can't you just do interviews? Why can't you just do focus groups or surveys? Well, the context tells you what it is they mean when they say something.
Yeah.
And we often talk about here, and this is maybe a little too poetic, but we talk about the silences in a meeting or a session or a birthday party are as important as the things that are said and who's there. So who's there and what is said and what people think about it and which kind of expressed opinions they have is important. But it's also important what isn't said, who's not invited, mm-hmm. and all the things that are not appropriate to say in the situation. Mm-hmm. So you can't get at that unless you're there. Mm-hmm. So it's describing what that experience is like. So I don't know if you have children, but not being invited to a birthday party is probably as telling and as important to you than being invited.
Sure.
So without the silences, without the contextual explanation of why people say what they say and why they don't say some things. So I'll give you an example. Today it is available to people to be an account executive. You can say, I'm an account executive, I'd like to be successful in being an account executive, or I want to be an account executive when I get a job. That's available to you. What's not available and what isn't reasonable to say is, I want to be a knight when I grow up, or my job is to be a saint. Mm-hmm. You could say that in the 1500s. Mm-hmm. That was available to you, and it wasn't available to be an account executive. Mm-hmm. So what are the things that you can even say that are reasonable to say is quite important to the picture of why people do what they do, why they drive, which cars they drive, why they have the practices they have, why they like to eat in a particular way, why they like some services rather than others. Those are all embedded in a general understanding. Now, when you have that, you can then say, if this is the case, if this might be the case, could we run that against a data set that's 300,000 people and how they click or swipe or buy or, say things? But it gives you sort of an understanding of the causation that goes beyond the correlation.
Exactly. And so, I think a big I think a big thing that I got from what you were saying in your book, you know, is I think that even with secondary data set, there's a tendency that people to want to run with that and draw conclusions off of that. But that's also dangerous because, you know, because it's still not experiencing why with the actual people who you're trying to persuade, connect with, influence, why they're doing what they're doing and really reaching what I think is most important, an understanding of them.
Exactly. And if you want to target someone or sell something to someone or influence someone, isn't it nice to understand who they are? I mean, if you live in Manhattan or if you live in San Francisco, mm-hmm. it's very likely that your world experience and the conclusions you draw and your background understanding something are completely different mm-hmm. than someone that lives in Idaho or lives in, you know, Shenzhen.
Yep.
And relying on your own intuitions mm-hmm. In order to understand without going and trying to challenge your own intuitions and suspend your own preconceived notions and presuppositions about something, it strikes me as completely idiotic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, an experience of living in Brooklyn and working in Manhattan is not congruent with who they want to sell, you know, soft yeah. drinks or cars to.
It makes me want to jump to something about sense making that I found is really interesting. And I find about the approach that's simple, but not easy. In one sense, you know, it's very kind of direct, proactive thing, you know, go out there and meet people, go out there and get to know the kinds of people that you're trying to reach, really understanding people and creating for them. And so I see that there's something simple about that, about getting out there, but maybe not easy. You know, what are the factors, you know, that people, you know, person saying like, hey, you know, I'm taking a look at all this data and I'm hearing this conversation. Why don't I go out and meet these people? You know, what are the things that they need to consider as they go in and kind of get out into the field that would help them be more successful in kind of really getting that raw kind of lively experience of what the people are experiencing.
Right. They need to do something really hard, mm-hmm. really, really hard, which is listening. Mm-hmm. It is so hard. I mean, right now, you and I probably have let's say there are three types of listening. Mm-hmm. The first type is waiting to say something yourself. Mm-hmm. And all you're waiting for is this sort of small beat of time where you can say what it is really you're thinking about. So all you're listening for is your turn to speak and what you want to say. Mm-hmm. That's one type of listening, and I do that most of the time.
Sure.
And I try to catch myself in doing it. Second one is trying to interpret what the other one is saying. So trying to understand why is this person saying what they're saying. So that's the second one. And the third one is much harder, which is being open and vulnerable enough mm-hmm. to be willing to accept that you might be wrong and that you might end up changing your perspective on things. That's the kind of listening that we do very, very rarely mm-hmm. and that some people are trained in. So the anthropologists I've met and some of the psychologists I've met mm-hmm. and some people just by mere nature and sort of vulnerability and curiosity and listening in the third level I'm talking about. So critical thinking is exploring what others might mean, threaten you, that could change you, and so on. Mm-hmm. And that's the technique or the ability, you know, being open and vulnerable enough to do that is so hard, and people have so many ready-made opinions. Mm-hmm. So to my students, I teach at the New School for Social Research, where I teach these kind of things, and I always say, I don't care what you think. I really couldn't care less about what you think. I care how you think, the way with which you think. And then, of course, when you've thought in this way and been listening in this way, then I might care about what you think.
Yeah.
But only then.
Yeah, for sure. It sounds like, you know, it reminds me of a book, Yiddish Cop, by Rabbi Nilton Bonder. And what he kind of talks about, it's a problem-solving methodology kind of informed by Talmud and the Jewish rabbinical tradition, but what he says, you know, is the ability that you're speaking to is, I think, the ability for a person to be self-reflective and be able to first label ignorances. You know, what don't I know, or what do I think I know about this? What are the perceptions I have? Which is, I think, really important leverage actually to in order to get insight, because what do I think I know about this? How does that question, and how does engaging question what I think I know? It seems like that's at heart, you know, a very important thing when you're going out to meet people, even if you were to do a focus group. What are the preconceptions that I'm bringing into this, and how can I put them to the side? How can I bracket them? Is that what you're saying too?
Yes, I call it suspending judgment.
Mm. Yeah.
Wait. Just look and listen.
Yeah.
And it's so hard. It's so hard to do.
Yeah.
But it's maybe the most powerful skill humans have if we want to understand each other. And I think it is a skill in decline. So we teach our kids debating class and writing opinion pieces about things, having opinions about this or that. We don't, and we say we teach critical thinking, but if it is critical thinking, it's not independent thinking.
Yeah.
And it's not a vulnerable, self-reflective, catching your own biases and assumptions kind of thinking. And I think in the professional life, as much as in the political life, you know, having very quick opinions about why people do what they do or what's meaningful to people and so on.
That brings me to think about the kind of sensibility that you're speaking to, and that this is definitely a sensibility of approaching information that's really important. Now, I'm trying to go back to the questions that I had this. It's like, it speaks to the way that we're using information. And when I was talking to Graham in the interview before, but it's the idea when we're using algorithms, when we're opining and stuff like that, we're really trying to reduce a situation so we think we can understand it. And I'm also thinking the moral perspective, but I'm trying to think about persuading people who are, you know, busy marketers and everything like that, but that we're actually shooting ourselves. It seems like we're shooting ourselves in the foot when we're thinking that way. And we're trying to connect with people and trying to gather lively insights to reach people. What do you think about that?
I think there's a place for many things. I think there's a place for reduction.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a place for big data. I think there's a vast place for big data.
Sure.
And algorithmic correlation between things. I think there's a big place for randomized trial. Mm-hmm. I just don't think it works for causation unless there's a significant amount of the kind of sensibility we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And I think data and algorithms have given people easy answers. And I have a problem with easy answers. I think there's a time and place for reducing people to particular actions, particular opinions, mm-hmm. and so on, in order to test hypotheses. But those hypotheses need to have the contextual understanding.
And it sounds like to me, you know, the thing that I was getting when we were talking is that maybe that there's some funny stories of your experience, you know, some funny stories of your experience with your strategic consulting in this way of kind of moving beyond your own preconceptions and stuff. Are any, what are the ways in which the kind of listening that you're doing has moved you and kind of shifted your perspective in ways that, you know, have helped your clients?
Well, I think there are two answers to that. The first one is I've over 20 years of doing this. I've developed an allergy for experts.
Mm-hmm.
People that play the role of expert. And I think the correct answer to a question that someone might have, which is, why is this not growing? Why is this not selling? How might we change it? This feels wrong. Is not, here's the answer. It is, I don't know, but let's have a look. So that's the first thing that I've really learned from. I mean, I mostly consulted for companies in real trouble. And that have lost the understanding of who they're serving. and the context around it. And you can imagine that right now I spend a lot of time in Northern California and in the Detroit area, because there, that's where the trouble is right now. Yeah. And let alone Washington, D.C., but that's an area I don't want to touch. Yeah. And I've learned from studying people that I'm always wrong. Mm. So I have, you know, it's impossible not to have some sense or some intuition about a group of people or a topic that people have, whether that is, you know, online dating or driverless cars or whatever it is. Mm. I'm almost always wrong when we go and have a look. Mm-hmm. And it's a humbling experience to know, I mean, I know now that my intuition about even the most banal topics, I shouldn't say anything about it with any sort of force before I have thought about it. So it's a little bit like a non-tribalist process. So, and if I should give one piece of advice, people should, the listeners to this podcast should not read my book. Mm-hmm. They should read the second chapter in John Stuart Mill's On Liberty.
Ooh, dig it. Okay, great.
And it's a short text, but it's a compass for how to think.
Yeah.
And it's just of such incredible clarity.
Yeah. Excellent. You know, the one last question, one very last question I have is that it seems behind the kind of, I don't know, kind of reconnaissance-based, kind of intelligence-based ways in which we try and get insights on people, you know, the kind of getting over, you know, getting on over without asking, it seems like it almost seems as if for me, and I'm wondering what you think, as if there's a fear because we're afraid to relate to other people in certain ways, but then also, it also speaks to the ways in which the basin in which that we engage in, you know, truth finding, truth in relationships with people. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, it's nicer to stay in your office and not having to go to Newark Airport or the train station and get the data in a clean fashion and go make a coffee and talk to your colleagues that you like. It's so much easier to convince yourself that the data analytics tool we have are the answer to mm-hmm. these kinds of things, than having to go to Indiana or Southern France. Well, Southern France sounds nice, but so does Indiana, by the way. But going there, mm-hmm. if you want to study children, you can't do that without getting down to their pace of life and their way of thinking and, I don't know, up maybe is a better metaphor. So without doing the hard work of listening, you end up making a lot of mistakes and you may end up misunderstanding what your job is really. So I would really recommend people to move, try to get into the lives of others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you do that, it's magical. So it is rewarding from a personal perspective. And, you know, if you listen in the way I talked about, then it might change you. Mm-hmm. And you might get wiser by it. But also you will be much more effective at your work, and which I think is important too. I mean, your career, you spend 8-10 hours a day mm-hmm. doing this. Why not do it in a way that's grounded in understanding.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, the what you were trying to paint out there, kind of being caught in the office, you know, getting data and stuff. I was like, no, that sounds so boring. You know, get out there and meet people, get out there and see what they're doing, and get out there and do it with them so you have something to talk about. And I think that it's much more effective because if you're listening to people and really caring, you know, then you can actually kind of create for them more as well. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, Christian, I just wanted to thank you so much for this interview and talking today. Did you have anything else you wanted to say?
No, my pleasure. Thank you so much for thinking about this. It's helpful and necessary.
Thank you so much, Christian. You take care, okay?
You too.